The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Uddhava, Brahma himself, who is born directly from the body of the Lord and who is the creator of all living entities within the material world, being the best of the demigods, seriously contemplated the question of his sons headed by Sanaka. The intelligence of Brahma, however, was affected by his own activities of creation, and thus he could not discover the essential answer to this question." So we can chant responsibly. The Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "My dear Uddhava, Brahma himself, who is born directly from the body of the Lord, and who is the creator of all living entities within the material world, being the best of the demigods, seriously contemplated the questions of his sons headed by Sanaka. The intelligence of Brahma, however, was affected by his own activities of creation, and thus he could not discover the essential answer to this question." Purport: Srila Jiva Goswami has quoted three verses from the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam as follows. In the ninth chapter, verse 32, Lord Krishna blessed Brahma with realized knowledge of the Lord's actual form, qualities and activities. In the ninth chapter, verse 37, the Lord ordered Brahma to rigidly carry out the Lord's injunctions and affirmed that Brahma would thus never be bewildered in his cosmic decision making. In the sixth chapter, verse 34, Lord Brahma assured his son Narada, "O Narada, because I have caught hold of the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, with great zeal, whatever I say has never proved to have been false, nor is the progress of my mind ever deterred, nor are my senses ever degraded by temporary attachment to matter." In the present verse, in this 13th chapter of the 11th canto, Lord Krishna states that Brahma unfortunately did become bewildered by his creative functions, thus providing a grave lesson to all of the Lord's empowered representatives. Although one may be elevated to an exalted position in the Lord's transcendental service, at any moment there is danger of false pride polluting one's devotional mentality. So, the sages, headed by Sanaka, have asked Lord Brahma these questions, which we read previously. We read in text number 16 that the Supreme Personality of Godhead said, "Once the mental sons of Lord Brahma, namely the sages headed by Sanaka, inquired from their father about the difficult subject matter of the supreme goal of yoga. The sages headed by Sanaka said, 'O Lord, people's minds are naturally attracted to material sense objects, and similarly the sense objects in the form of desire enter within the mind. Therefore, how can a person who desires liberation, who desires to cross over activities of sense gratification, destroy this mutual relationship between the sense objects and the mind? Please explain this to us." And the Lord describes here in this verse today that Lord Brahma could not satisfactorily answer that question because his intelligence had been affected materially by his dealings with the material energy, by his contact with the material energy. So Lord Krishna I'll just read the next one verse with this. Samam achintaya deva prajna para titirishaya tashyam hamsarupina sakasham agamam tadaha. So Krishna continued, Lord Brahma desired to attain the answer to the question that was puzzling him, and thus he fixed his mind on me, the Supreme Lord. At that time, in my form of Hamsa, I became visible to Lord Brahma. Purport. Hamsa means swan, and the specific ability of the swan is to separate a mixture of milk and water, extracting the rich, milky portion. Similarly, Lord Krishna appeared as Hamsa, or the swan, in order to separate the pure consciousness of Lord Brahma from the modes of material nature. So, Lord Krishna described that Brahma could not answer the question, and so he fixed his mind on Krishna, and the Lord appeared to him in the form of Hamsa the swan in order to answer the question that puzzled Lord Brahma and that was asked by the sages headed by Sanaka. So as described in this verse, Lord Brahma was actually assured by the Lord that he'd actually revealed to Lord Brahma, first of all, the Lord's form and qualities and activities, and he also assured Brahma that if he carried out his injunctions, that he would never be bewildered in his cosmic decision making. And Lord Brahma, of course, also stated, you know, that he felt very sure that he was properly situated at the lotus feet of Krishna, and therefore, you know, he would never be bewildered. But as described here, he was. He did become bewildered. So, sometimes devotees take these examples in the wrong way, and they think as a justification for doing things which are you know, a pollution to their devotional activities. You know, a deviation, either slightly or, you know, in a big way. And they will, someone may say, oh, you know, Prabhu, you're not following very properly the principles of devotional service. And they may say, well, you know, even Lord Brahma, you know, he became bewildered, you know, what to speak of me. And, you know, there are examples of, you know, Indra doing this and, you know, this one doing that. And, so in this way, they actually take the wrong lesson, as Srila Prabhupada describes. But you do hear a lot of that, you know, that devotees can justify from the Bhagavatam. So you know, utilize the Bhagavatam to justify, you know, sort of being a little bit of a rascal. But Prabhupada makes the point that's not what you take from here. What you actually take from these examples is that even great personalities, exalted personalities who are beyond our criticism. They are never subject to our criticism. They are so exalted. Even they can be, you know, temporarily bewildered by the association with the material energy. Therefore, how careful we should be, in our devotional service. Not that these examples are there, so therefore that's a good reason for me to be slack. But these examples are there, that's the reason why I should never be slack, you see. So people take the wrong principle. So Prabhupada very nicely corrects that mentality. And the false identification as somehow being pride enters, as I say, pride comes before a fall, that pride is the sense of a false understanding of our position. Actually, we are completely under the control of the Supreme Lord at any, for all eternity, actually. And whatever we're able to do, either materially or spiritually, is by the grace of the Lord, either directly or indirectly. Therefore, if we become proud, it means we've forgotten that fact. We see that here the Lord, at a particular stage, he actually explained to Lord Brahma about his qualities and form. While Lord Brahma was able to meditate upon the Lord's form, qualities and position, he was very certain of his position as a devotee, that he would not stumble. But as soon as we forget the qualities of the Lord, the position of the Lord, pride can enter, and then there can be that is the beginning of them becoming bewildered, because then we think that we are somehow an independent controller of our activities, and immediately we think that we're an independent controller and we're not drawing that strength from the Lord, then immediately, when we're not drawing the strength from the Lord, we're in a weakened position. And then immediately we're controlled by the Lord's, material energy. That becomes revealed. So that pride of false understanding, it can enter very, very quickly. And one has to always be on guard. There was a nice conversation with Srila Prabhupada, who was talking with some Indian devotees who had come from Kashmir, and he'd been travelling with some of his Western devotees as well, and I think he was in India at this stage. Anyway, naturally, in Srila Prabhupada, throughout many, many different conversations, had described some of the difficulties that he had in preaching in India. That, because there's a lot of hodgepodge ideas, it was very difficult, because you present Krishna and they present 100 other different gods, and you say that Krishna says surrender unto me, and they'll say no, it's yatamat tatapat, so many different. So anyway, these disciples who had accompanied Prabhupada on many of these different, they'd heard him in these different lectures and morning walks and what have you. Anyway, he was talking to this Indian devotee, and they were discussing at some point, and one of his American disciples started, you know, was just saying that, yes, you know, in America, you know, we accept you because of, you know, we had this qualification, you know, whereas in India, you know, there's, you know, there's this difficulty. So he was sort of almost echoing the same things that Prabhupada had said many times. But Srila Prabhupada immediately chastised him, you know. Don't think that you're better because you're American. Don't think you're better because you're a Westerner. You know, is that, you know, although if you hear Prabhupada speaking in his context, you know, there was certainly difficulty in India and like that. But in saying that, that doesn't mean that one is, because it was somehow he had some more success in the West, that they should become proud, because that's never allowed. Pride is never allowed. So, you know, oh, you know, we're Western. And that Prabhupada, you know, came to preach to us, we immediately took, you know. So he immediately chastised. And of course, the disciple, you know, went on to describe, oh, yeah, but what I was saying was, you know, like, trying to, but Prabhupada just smashed him again and again. Yeah. So, and of course, that, you know, disciple slightly quietened down and started to listen more and talk less. but you can see how subtle it is. He was almost repeating Prabhupada verbatim, even things that Prabhupada had said. Except for the thing that when Prabhupada said what he said, there was no pride meant for anyone. But when this disciple, even repeating, you know, pretty close to what Prabhupada said, but he said it with pride. And therefore, Prabhupada smashed it immediately. So it's very subtle. On the other hand, you know, if you ever disciples would always offer praise to Srila Prabhupada because he was very, very expert, you know, just completely empowered by the Lord, and he was, you know, what he did was you know, an unequaled achievement in the line of devotional service. There's no comparison. There's no one you can compare Prabhupada's achievement with. It is, you know, the top, and it is, you know, superlative. There's, you know, so but when, you know, people would praise Prabhupada, you know, he would say, yes, you know, people say that I have done this great thing and that great thing, but my only, you know, qualification is that I haven't changed anything. You know, my Guru Maharaj, you know, presented teachings as it is, and then as a messenger, I've just put that. So, Prabhupada was like that. Yet, on some very rare occasions, when the disciples discussed Prabhupada's achievements, you could see Prabhupada relished. Yes, you know, I did this, and, you know, like for instance, when he, I think it was in Japan, you know, he went to, was it Dai Nippon, to get his Bhagavad Gita, the first edition of the Bhagavad Gita, published, and he had $5,000, and he convinced them to print $40,000 worth of books. And he said, the money will come. And he was discussing this, you know, laughing, that, you know, how he tricked them, and that, you know, it was, you know, quite a feat. So he was sort of relishing, you know, those sankirtan activities. And the disciples were saying that actually some disciples who kept contact with those people, they said, those people still talk about what you did, you know, the people at Dainippon. They still talk about it. They said, in the whole history, you know, they had never done any business transactions with anyone like that. You either got the money, you give me the money, you know, and we'll pay. There may be, you know, a little credit, you know, $1,000, something, but, you know, $35,000 owing, you know, in the 70s, or 60s, that's massive, you know. It just doesn't happen. And they were, you know, they still talk about it, you know, that how did he do that? You know, like he came in, he had us all under some spell, completely bewildered, and we've said yes, we'll print all these Bhagavad Gita's, thousands and thousands of them, and you have no money. Yes, of course we will. Like this. Because Prabhupada was laughing, you know, enjoying. And so, you know, he, you know, in that conversation, they go on for quite a long time about all the different things that Prabhupada did. But, you know, in order to teach his disciples, whenever there was some credit, he always just, you know, pretty much standard, you know, all credit goes to my Guru Maharaj. But it doesn't mean that you can't, you know, relish. So when he was doing that, there was no pride though. That's the difference. That Lord Chaitanya, you know, empowers his devotees, and the Guru empowers his devotees to do amazing things. And it's actually very relishable to think about that. And, you know, you can talk about it with other devotees, you can discuss it, as long as there's no pride there. It's not that immediately someone is discussing, oh yes, I did this, that is pride. You know, we used to have Sankirtan meetings, and you know, at the end of the week here in Balaram, all the Sankirtan devotees would go up to Prabhupada's room. You count our money. We used to we'd sit there for, you know, a couple of hours, and each note we'd take all the creases out and put it in the right order. And we, you know, as we had nice mats, we put the money on the mats, and it's like, because, you know, it was Lakshmi, so it'd take a while. We'd just very carefully stack and fold, you know, so you'd see all these beautiful, nicely lined up stacks of money. And while we did that, we had a Sankirtan meeting. We discussed, you know, some of the things that needed to happen for next week, and we'd allocate different areas. So we used to have the Melways, and we'd photocopy Melways, and you get, you know, map 79 or what have you. So when you've been to every house, factory, and office in map 79, you get a new page. So anyway, we used to have, then we, you know, one of the favourite parts was Sankirtan stories, you know, and devotees would tell the different stories about, you know, what they did. But, you know, of course, you know, sometimes there's an element of pride there, but mostly it was just very relishable, you know, just unbelievable how Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is, you know, empowering devotees to do these unheard of things. Like, you know, Srila Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita, you know, just for religious literatures, especially Bhagavad Gita, something from, you know, the East, to be just, you know, distributed millions, you know, like the scores that were coming in, you know, that 40,000 Bhagavad Gita's gone out, you know, in a week in, you know, America, and 50,000 went out in Europe. You know, it's just unbelievable, you know. Lord Chaitanya's mercy. But, you know, and the way that devotees, I remember there was one devotee, he came from Scandinavia, and he was a very funny devotee, very tall. He could hardly speak English. He spoke English, but it wasn't very good. And he was a very simple person. He used to live in the woods, in I think it was Scandinavia or something, you know, living off honey and fruits, and you know, he was almost like one of the forest creatures there. But you know, he was very unsophisticated, very simple person. And he just loved to eat. That was, you know, his life. You know, we'd go into Vishadam, and he would just keep eating until there was nothing left in any of the trays. You know, we used to eat in the theatre in those days, and you know, they'd bring it all in, and you know, they'd serve the devotees. The Sankirtan leader, who was Atmaram at that stage, would, you know, make. He would walk around. He'd say, "Oh, you can't have them sweets, and you can't have this, and you can't." But this devotee, they just let him eat, you know, and he would just keep eating and eating. So you go back there an hour later, all the devotees, you know, they got the van packed, they're all dressed. He's still, you know, you just bring a little bit more of this halva, you know. So anyway, then he would go out on Sankirtan, and of course he'd be just, you know, he'd be just, you know. You'd be, you know, trying to wake him up. He's still got halva, you know, and sweet rice. No, seriously, I'm not joking. He's got the shardam all over his face and all down here like this. In those days, we used to have to wear wigs, so he's got his wig on sideways, you know. So, you know, he's sort of the saliva running down his face. Yeah, you'd wake him up. Come on, yeah, you know, sell these candles. Oh yeah, you know. He'd open the door, and like, you know, he'd only been going out for a few weeks. He had no idea what he's doing. And he'd walk in, and you know, you'd see him 15 minutes later. He'd say, "How'd you go?" "Oh yeah, sold them all, you know. He's got hundreds of dollars, you know. And you go back in, and you think, what are you saying to people, you know? And, you know, he'd load up with more, you know, candles or whatever, and he'd go in, and they just, people loved it. They just bought everything. They just look at him, "Yeah, I'll take whatever you got, man." So, you know, it was very, so, you know, it's Lord Chaitanya's mercy is, you know, quite phenomenal. So, you know, devotees may even discuss their own, you know, activities, but as long as it's not done with pride, but just, you know, in amazement, you know, "I can't believe, you know, what just happened." And there's, you know, all sorts of different stories. Probably one of my favourites that happened to me, you know, was that, I think I told this one when we had Bhakti Shastri once. We used to sell those candles, and there was a factory in Port Melbourne. And you know, if a devotee dropped a candle, you ever seen those Hawaiian candles? You dip them in wax, and they have all different colours, and then they carve them while they're hot and twist them around. They sometimes look like pineapples, you know. They're like a lantern candle. You ever seen those? We used to sell those. I think everyone in Melbourne had a couple, you know. It's like every, you know, everyone had bought them. Anyway, we were getting to the point where, you know, like candles, yeah, you know. Aside from the fact that they used to sort of, people would put them on their television, they'd light them up, they'd melt down the back of the telly and blow their telly up. People sort of started to lose interest in them, you know. But anyway, we were almost ready to merge into the next pair of Nova, but there was a whole warehouse, and all the broken ones just hundreds and hundreds of broken candles. You know, arms broken off. Some of them they'd actually got to them with an axe because they thought, you know, we'll chip off the outside, get down to the base and re-dip them. And they did that with some of them, and, you know, they didn't quite work, so they went back on the shelf as well. And anyway, they said, what are we going to do with them? And I said, oh, I'll sell them. So, you know, because you just sort of, you know, as by the mercy of Lord Chaitanya, it's you know, quite inconceivable what can happen. Anyway, I had this plan. We used to go to these big factories, and yeah, most people would buy what we had. I don't know why, it's, you know, part of their culture, not being condescending, but the only people it was very, very difficult to sell to was when you had a factory of workers, and they're mostly Greek or Italian. I'm not being, you know, but the reason is because whatever you had, whether it was $100 or $50 or $20, they would say, I'll give you $5. And therefore you could never sell anything. Unless you sold everything for $5, you could never sell it. It wouldn't matter. You say, hey, look, here's a painting, it's worth, you know, $200, I'll give you $5 for it. So anyway, I thought, you know, perhaps they might buy these candles. So I went into some of these factories, and I would put my box of candles and I would show them the good one. And I'd say, you know, $20, $25. And someone would say, I'll give you $5. Oh, no, no, I can't take $5. No, I'll give you $5. And you, by this stage, you've got, you know, 40, 50 people around. Look, I'm not selling these for $5. You hold out as long as you can. And you, oh, look, if you all buy, you can have them for $5. And then they just, hands just come from everywhere. Of course, by this stage, you know, some of the more broken ones start to magically appear. Hands coming from everywhere. And, you know, you've sold 50 candles. And then you go into the next, you know. Anyway, that's how we go. There's a Christmas marathon. Now, I got down to the last couple of boxes. Now, you can imagine these candles. You wouldn't give them to your dog. They didn't even look like candles. Seriously, you wouldn't know what it was. So, but I'd run out of these factories. And the only thing that I had left was some, everything was closed down, was, you know, everything shut down. And I thought, you know, okay, whatever's open I've got to do, and I've got to sell these last candles. I'm not finishing until I've sold that last broken candle. So there was this office, and I thought, okay, they were having like a break-up Christmas party. I thought, I'll go up there. So they're all dressed in suits, ties, you know, they're actually quite, you know, wealthy looking people, well paid. And I walked in, I thought, this is really, you know, a test of Lord Chaitanya's, you know, mercy that upon both me and these people, you know, that, and you know, if he does something quite extraordinary, then otherwise there's no way. So you know, I walked in and I said to them, look, you know, I've got some candles here, you know, and, you know, it's Christmas, would you like them? And I pulled one out and they're going, like, right. And, and anyway, I said to them, look, you know, it's my last day. You're the last place I'm coming to. I've sold thousands of these. I said, I don't know why, but people love them. I said, I've sold them all, so you're the lucky people, you get the last ones, you know, and this is your last opportunity. So they said, yeah, look, I'll have one, mate. You know, thinking it's a rare opportunity. And they took all the candles and all, you know, gave me the money. So at the end, I'm standing there, you know, all their money in my hands. And they've got these candles and they're... All of a sudden it hits them. It's like, what just happened here? And they're looking at this bit of rubbish in their hands and thinking, we all just bought a chunk of wax that looks like nothing. What the hell? You know? And they're like this. And I'm just grinning from ear to ear, you know, like, you, I can't believe you just did that, you know. And I'm standing there with all this money in my hand, and it's like, Merry Christmas. See you later. I walked on. So, it's, so, you know, it's just the mercy of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, anyway, the point being that we should, you know, be careful of pride, but at the same time, the mercy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu can make even unqualified people do some extraordinary things as devotees. And the amazing thing, even a personality, and this is another point that Srila Prabhupada would draw, that even though someone like Lord Brahma can be bewildered, that even a very unqualified person can become a pure devotee and go back to Godhead by the Lord's grace. That's the point. That's, you know, that we should not think that, you know, if Lord Brahma becomes bewildered, what hope is there for me? That's, you know, the point is understanding the Lord's mercy. Everything depends upon the Lord's mercy. Without the Lord's mercy, even a qualified like person like Lord Brahma can become bewildered. And with the Lord's mercy, then even an unqualified person can go back to Godhead. So I'll just leave it there if anyone has any questions or comments. Any of that? Or some Sankirtan stories?
Yes, sometimes in books, half the time I don't even approach the person that book. I'm trying to get out a book and someone just comes up to me, what are you talking? Can I have one?
That's a fact. Yeah, you can perceive the Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's potency in action.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because materially, you know, you can't quite conceive the different services that a devotee may be allocated. You think, you know, how will I ever be qualified to do this service, you know? But if you actually just perform the service, then by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's grace, you actually become qualified. Srila Prabhupada sort of had that policy of training on the job. He would certainly try and get the best persons for, you know, particular jobs as far as suitable. But in most cases, you know, no one was really qualified. And but he knew that if you just do the job, you do the service, by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's grace, you become qualified. Therefore, you know, we should have that sort of sense when we're dealing with devotees as well, that sometimes, you know, devotees may have particular services and we may see some faults or criticism because we may feel that they're not completely qualified, which may be a fact. But you know, we should understand the process that if they perform that service, then by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, by the mercy of the Guru and Gauranga, if they're sincere, they actually will become, you know, qualified more and more day by day within time. And that was always Srila Prabhupada's, you know, policy. But of course, when one does develop some qualifications, then we should be very careful not to think, well, now, you know, I am the most qualified person for this particular service, and forget that we've actually become qualified by the mercy of Guru and Gauranga. Because as soon as we feel like that and that pride enters, immediately become disqualified, and it's surprising how even a simple thing will become an impossible task. So there's a verse in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that for one who remembers the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, difficult things become very easy to execute. And for one who forgets the lotus feet of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, very simple things become very difficult. So therefore, you do see that sometimes some very, very qualified devotees, even who may have had a lot of association with Guru and maybe very, very well shastrically, you know, read and very experienced as devotees, if they forget the lotus feet of Guru Gauranga, even a simple task in devotional service, even some of the basic principles, they can no longer follow. Whereas those, you know, who remember the lotus feet of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then something which is, you know, seems to be impossible beyond their jurisdiction or qualification, they find it very, may find it very easy to do by the Lord's grace. And, you know, of course, here with reference to this purport, you know, the difficult task here that the Sanak and the sages are inquiring about is how to actually become free from sense gratification, how to become free from sex desire. For most people in this world, including, you know, many devotees who take up the process of devotional service, it seems like it's just the most impossible thing. But Prabhupada always maintained a position that if you remember the Lord and Guru, it'll actually become very easy for you. So the principle is quite, as Prabhupada said, you know, it's the application is sometimes difficult. The method is actually quite simple. Always remember the Lord and depend on His mercy. That's quite easy. Application means, you know, we just got to do it. If we don't do it, then everything becomes very difficult. So, you know, that's the that's what the sages are saying here, that even Lord Brahma found it difficult to, you know, become free ultimately from that desire for sense gratification. And Prabhupada will give the example of Haridas Thakur. Because Haridas Thakur was considered to be, you know, an incarnation of Lord Brahma within Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Leela. So you see that it's not how you start, how you finish. I know my spiritual master said that to me, obviously seeing what a fool I am, is giving me some encouragement. So Ganga, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. There's a saying in India that, I don't know the Sanskrit or Bengali, what have you, but, you know, you say, basically, because my mother was born naked, therefore, you know, why is she wearing clothes? See? It doesn't make sense, you know. If you say, or, you know, this person was born, you know, without clothes, now see, my mother's wearing clothes. What is it? She shouldn't have no clothes. You know, it's a foolish proposition. So, you know, and people think, you know, this person was born in the West. How can they take up, you know, how can they become a Brahmana? No, they can't. You know. Right? It's not how you start. It's what you're qualified to do now. It's a ridiculous proposition. You know. So therefore, again, we see with Lord Brahma, we shouldn't consider, oh, there was some momentary lapse of Krishna consciousness. But, yeah, look, you know, as Haridas Thakur, when he was tested again by Maya, and she appeared in the form, you know, a very beautiful woman, you know, wanting to entice him for sense gratification. And he said that, yeah, you know, when I finish my chanting, you know, yes, we will enjoy like this. Because he had no intention. He was just thinking, you know, this poor, wretched person is, you know, trying to find some happiness in sex life. What a horrible condition. You know, perhaps I can deliver them. You know. So he stayed there and he chanted. And of course, to the next day, he said, oh, I still haven't finished. So I think it went on for 3 days. You know. And then by that time, she'd been hearing this pure chanting, and then she became his disciple. So Srila Prabhupada describes that, you know, one who remembers, you know, chants the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra and remembers the Lord that way, you know, even that person may appear not to be such a very exalted person, then they're capable of, you know, stepping on the head and material energy and giving up sex life, and which is the real, you know, that's the real problem, of course. If you think about it, if there was no sex desire, and, you know, then, yeah, let's all go back to Godhead. There's nothing else here. You know, birth and death, old age and disease is not much worth hanging around for. There's one thing that you think, oh, you know, I'm a bit doubtful about giving up, and, you know, I'm still a bit attached to this sex desire, basically. And so, you know, if a devotee can conquer that one thing, you know, the progress in spiritual life, of course, very rapid. It's that one obstacle, but it's very difficult. But as impossible as it may be, this is the teachings. How to, you know, always be able to separate spiritual activities, which are nectar, from the mundane activities, which are poison. Or that which is not wanted, from that which is wanted. As we gave the example that Prabhupada, when he was talking with his disciple, and even though his disciple was almost repeating the same thing Prabhupada had said, but there was a little bit of poison in amongst that little bit of pride. So Prabhupada was able to recognize what was wanted and something which is to be discarded, and he immediately did that. And that's the Paramahamsa, they can see. So here, the Lord actually appears as Hamsa to teach that process, which is Bhakti Yoga, how to always separate spiritual activities from material activities which are not wanted. That is the Paramahamsa, and here the Lord, the Paramahamsa is the devotee of Hamsa, and the Lord himself is Hamsa, the swan, because swans have that ability to, you know, separate the spiritual aspect of anything, the part that's wanted, that's relishable, and leave aside, even though they appear to be mixed up, the watery part, which is, they don't want to drink that, they just want the milk. So that can actually, a swan can separate that milk like that. So the Paramahamsa, they take shelter of Hamsa, the Lord, and they can do that. And the way they do that is by always hearing and chanting, constantly hearing, chanting, remembering about the Lord, his pastimes and activities. As soon as we start, you know, hearing and chanting about mundane activities and mundane things, then, like Lord Brahma, you can quickly again become bewildered. And that is considered to be a place of pilgrimage for crows. I was telling you this story the other day. The crows, they like dirty, filthy, you know, rubbishy type things. And the swans, they, you know, like if you go around the park, you see the swans, you know, very, very graceful, very elegant. They like, you know, nice parks and, you know, open spaces and pure water. I saw you chanting, walking around the other day, chanting. You see, the devotees, you know, they congregate in those places and they chant the holy names of God. So, actually, I was driving past and I saw a couple of swans walking across the road. And, you know, usually if you see birds or animals crossing the road, it's like they see the cars and they just bolt, you know, get across that road. The swans, if you watch them, you go, they just... It's described in the Bhagavad Gita that actually Rukmini, she walked with the like a swan. Very, you know, each step delicately, beautifully placed like this. So you see the swans there. The cars are just waiting. You know, it's like, you know, 20 minutes. The swan's still crossing the road. You know, they just, you know, just. So that is they're not in a hurry. So swans are like that, and the crows are like that. So I was telling the story the other day. I had this unusual, you know, dream, and we went to this dilapidated sort of a house. Prabhupada was there and there were some devotees in it, and I was saying, you know, no one owns this house, you know, we could use it for a temple. And, you know, Prabhupada was saying, yeah, that'd be good, that'd be nice temple. And I noticed that there was like a sort of a seat, and on the seat was a murti, a Balaram, and he was sort of seated like this. And very beautiful. And I walked over, and it was just covered in dust. And I walked over, and here he's about that big. I started wiping the dust. I think, gee, people must have just thought he was a stone, you know, because he's made from like marble. And they probably thought he was a stone, So I was wiping the dust, you know, thinking, they don't know he's Balaram. Like this. As I'm wiping the dust, he reaches out and he grabs me by the hands and he pulls me in. He starts talking, you know, to me, and he's saying, Bhakti, Tita. And I'm thinking, I'm looking up to that devotee, I'm thinking, can you see this? And but they can't, you know. They're like, I don't know, Prabhupada was somewhere else at that stage, but they're just doing the stuff they had known. And he's talking, I'm saying, he's talking. Like this. And he's saying about Bhakti Tita, and I'm thinking, why aren't I listening? This Balaram talking to me, you know, like this. And it was really amazing because his hands were like very powerful. There's no way you could resist that pull, you know. He was just bulging. But soft. You could barely feel that touch, you know. So strong, but soft. And I woke up and I thought, you know, what was this about Bhakti Tirtha? What was he saying? And then... later, I thought, I bet you if I hear, you know, Prabhupada's tapes, then, you know, Prabhupada will mention it, you know. I was painting a house. I listened about 15 tapes. Anyway, finally Prabhupada started talking about it, and he told this story that when he started the Mayapur Centre, he first built the quarters for the devotees, not for the deities, not for the Lord. And many of the locals and different Vaishnavas criticized, you know, what are you doing? You know, that's an offense. You know, you're building quarters for devotees to live in. You should build for the Lord first. He was saying no. Because if you put a statue of the Lord there, they'll think it is stone. And it'll be neglected. But if you bring the devotees, then the Lord becomes manifest and everyone will worship the Lord. If the deity is there, the devotees first, and then the deity is there, and they will see the bhakti, because you know the bhakti of the devotees, then the Lord manifests. So bhakti tirtha, tirtha is a holy place. The Lord will manifest in that place, and people will perceive the manifestation of the Lord because of the bhakti of the devotees. And then you describe, but you know others, their tirtha. There's that verse in the first canto, I think it's 1.5.11 or something, that you know those who hear other topics other than the transcendental glories of the Lord spoken by the devotees, that's a place of pilgrimage for crows. So he was describing this, that there's a place of pilgrimage for crows, and then there's a place of pilgrimage for the paramahamsas, the devotees, who are always hearing and chanting and glorifying the Lord. And if you're in that association of devotees, then the Lord manifests very nicely. So that is the bhakti tirtha. So that was, you know, I thought that's exactly what, you know, Bhagavan was talking about in that dream. That was interesting. So, you know, that's the process that Prabhupada gave us. Always hear and chant in the association of devotees, and by that process, even we may be the most unqualified person, you can actually become, you know, paramahamsa and go back to the spiritual world. That's the point. Any other questions or comments?